otherwise you could have just knocked on the door and we would have brought Jessica down and given her to you. There wasn't really any need for this rescue.
Once you are suspected of being a terrorist, constitutional protections are gone out of the window, leaving people like myself in constant fear and anxiety.
You know, mercenaries are the ones who pull the triggers, and we just train people how to pull the triggers. So we're sort of maybe like executive mercenaries.
What we find is that in the first 7 weeks after September 11th, when they locked up 1,200 people, of those 1,200 people, only three have been charged with any kind of crime related to terrorism.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, May 14th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The simultaneous suicide strikes on three foreign compounds were carried out by 15 Saudis, resulting in an overall death toll of 34, including at least 7 Americans and 9 attackers. Saudi Prince Saud Al-Faisal would not give details on what happened to the 6 surviving attackers. The Saudi foreign minister said today at a press conference, "The fact that the terrorism happened is an indication of shortcomings in security, and we have to learn from our mistakes and seek to improve our performance in this respect." Despite a claim by the U.S. ambassador, Saud said he had not received a request from the diplomat to intensify security measures around the U.S. installations. Al-Qaeda, the terror group linked to the attacks and to September 11th, had railed against the presence of foreign troops in Saudi Arabia, home to the holiest Muslim shrines. Monday's attacks came as the United States announced plans to pull out most of the 5,000 troops it had based in Saudi Arabia by autumn. But in addition to the 5,000 troops, there's a private U.S. military corporation called VNEL, who are, by their own definition, executive mercenaries. Bill Hartung is director of the Arms Trade Resource Center and senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. In an article in the Progressive magazine entitled "Mercenaries, Inc., How a U.S. Company Props Up the House of Saud," Hartung recounts an incident in the past when VNEL was a target of terrorism.
I first wrote a story about VNEL back in 1996, a few months after a similar bombing in Saudi Arabia at the Saudi National Guard headquarters. And I pointed out at that time that it wasn't just an attack on the Saudi National Guard, but it was an attack on VNEL, the U.S. contractor that was helping to train them. And it didn't get as much attention that time because I don't believe any VNEL personnel were killed in that earlier attack, and it wasn't nearly as severe.
Although 5 Americans were killed there, were they not?
In the prior one, yes. But this was multiple sites, 100 people killed, hundreds injured. It was a much harder thing to ignore. You know, I think any attack happening after September 11th has a different resonance. But in any case, I tried to make the point back then that the reason VNEL was targeted was not some sort of, you know, senseless terrorism or, misdirected anger. There was a very specific reason they were chosen. Mm-hmm. They are in charge of training and arming the Saudi National Guard, and the Saudi National Guard has been described by Jane's Defense Weekly, hardly a radical publication, as the Praetorian Guard, basically the entity that protects the Saudi government, not so much from foreign adversaries, but from its own people. It's basically, it enforces internal order. There were points in the 70s when there were rebellions in and around Mecca when this National Guard had to go and put down rebellions by the Saudi people. The understanding is that VNEL personnel may have not only given logistical advice, but may have even been involved in some of the fighting back then to defend the regime. So they have a long history as kind of a pillar of the Saudi monarchy, and so it's quite natural that Al-Qaeda would have targeted them, as they did in the mid-90s. What I think this does do is it shines a spotlight on this whole phenomenon of private military companies. Mm-hmm. You have companies like DynCorp, which is providing protection for Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan under contract, also has been involved in running a private air force for the State Department to bomb drug labs and defoliate areas in the Andes and Colombia. And you've got VNEL, you've got a company called MDRC, Military Defense Resources mm-hmm. Corporation. But the idea from the point of view of military planners was, well, you know, if we use private companies, it's not U.S. troops in uniform. So if one of them gets killed, it doesn't have the same political backlash. Second of all, they've got more flexibility. They can hire these folks for a short term and then pull them out. And, of course, they get very experienced people because in the case of Enel, when they started this up in the 70s, they hired recently retired Special Forces people, and they actually had former head of training for the Army helping them recruit folks. So people said, well, isn't this just basically hiring yourself out as a mercenary? And Peter Arnett, when he was a print reporter, actually asked one of these guys who worked for Vanel, you know, doesn't this make you mercenaries? You're basically being paid to protect this undemocratic regime. And the guy said, well, you know, mercenaries are the ones who pull the triggers, and we just train people how to pull the triggers. So we're sort of maybe like executive mercenaries. And he just laughed. It's not funny anymore when people start getting killed in terror bombings, when the role of Vanel is seen as part and parcel of the role of the United States in propping up that regime.
So what exactly are they doing? Are they training other Saudi Arabians, or are they pulling the triggers as well?
They're primarily involved in training Saudis. Now, both the National Guard, and they've got another program with the Navy. I think they've got at least 1,300 people in country. And so it's supposed to be training in how to use the weapons, in tactics for crowd control, undoubtedly how to use various high-tech communications gear, you know, how to benefit from the U.S. equipment. But, you know, in those cases, sometimes that training relationship will cross the line. We sent trainers into the Philippines recently, and there were reports that they were involved in fighting, not just training Philippine forces. There's been issues about that in Colombia, where some of these folks are basically running combat missions and bombing drug labs. But, of course, the problem with privatization is they hand it over to a private company. They often get rid of the people in the government who would be able to keep tabs on them. So we may not know whether these guys were also involved in combat or patrols against the Saudi populace, or whether they stuck to the training rule.
And the other thing is, who are they accountable to, and what standards are they required to uphold? Are they required to uphold the standards of the Saudis or whatever country they're operating in, or do they have some sort of nebulous standard that they have to adhere to that they exact for themselves?
Well, that's a huge issue. There's an article, I think it's still in the current Mother Jones, called Full Metal Racket, which is about these private military companies. And they pointed out that in the Balkans, DynCorp was involved in training the Croatians right before they went in and did a massive ethnic cleansing in the Krajina area. And they got no consequences for their role in that. Also, there were members of the DynCorp team who were running a prostitution ring using teenage and pre-teenage Bosnian girls and selling them for sex. And when one of the DynCorp employees reported that to his higher-ups, he was fired for bringing it up. And it was only after a lawsuit and all kinds of other stuff that those people were pulled out of the area, and they've never suffered any criminal penalty. So there's a real issue with a company like Vanel or DynCorp. Are they accountable to the laws of war? In this case, the Saudi government is paying for it. They sometimes, depending on the size of the contract and how much equipment's involved, sometimes they will use the Pentagon as a broker. So the Pentagon will arrange for the equipment and services. The Saudis will pay the Pentagon. The Pentagon will then release it to the company as a defense contract. But nonetheless, the checks are being written by the monarchy. And I think that's, to a large degree, where Vanel's loyalties would be, assuming they have loyalties.
Bill Hartung is director of the Arms Trade Resource Center and senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. The Bush administration is insisting that the military democracy currently being installed in occupied Iraq will not be allowed to vote in an Islamic theocracy. But that restriction could soon come under challenge, judging by this week's triumphal return from Iran of the exiled Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim. The White House is hoping to offset al-Hakim's popularity by throwing its support behind another Ayatollah whose leadership vision is more to Washington's liking. Professor Stuart Shar, co-author of the new Middle East and Islamic World Reader, has been following al-Hakim's career and explains the U.S. effort to pacify Iraq with a divide-and-conquer strategy of dueling Ayatollahs.
The Ayatollah al-Hakim pre-negotiated with the U.S. administration in Iraq before returning. He had a militia of 15,000 men which were armed and trained in Iran. Those people infiltrated back into Iraq during pilgrimage ceremonies that took place, unarmed. Once they got into Iraq, there are so many arms around from liberated arsenals that were looted along with museums and the National Library and other edifices, that arms are a dime a dozen in the country, so those 15,000 can be rearmed very, very rapidly, and I imagine that they have been. The negotiations took place around the following. Al-Hakim demanded that he have a phalanx of troops that would surround him at all times. And the U.S. allowed 200 of them. This contrasts with Ahmed Shalabi's 700. And the interesting thing is that these 200 did not show their arms in his very important, that is, Al-Hakim's very important promenade, which is part of religious tradition. Kings in the Islamic world used to do promenades in order to make sure to collect taxes, gain loyalty of the population. People have to see you in the flesh to believe that you're important, that you're there, and they have to touch you. So that Al-Hakim made his promenade from Kuwait, working his way up through Basra, and going to the symbolic holy city of Najaf, which is the burial place of the Imam Ali, who is the font of Shiite Islam. I expect him to make a dramatic entrance into Karbala, where Ali's son is buried, and where some of the most important Shiite passion plays take place, commemorating the martyrdom of Ali's son Hussein that happened in 680 of the common era, and for Shiites is as if it happened yesterday. Well, the Ayatollahs, in the brand of Islam that exists in Iraq, of the connection to a descendant of Ali who disappeared in the 900s and is supposed to come back. He's not dead, according to Shiite theology. He is called the Hidden Imam. And that Hidden Imam is expected to return one day and usher in the Day of Judgment. And the connection to the Hidden Imams are none other than the Ayatollahs of Shiite Islam. Therefore, Al-Hakim, as a major Ayatollah who has suffered martyrdom himself by 25 members of his families being executed by Saddam Hussein, the first thing he did when he came into Iraq was to remind the population of how many members of his family were executed. It's a martyrdom complex which he's building on. And it meant that even if he had to be outside of the country, his immediate family suffered because of his political opposition to the Ba'ath regime and to Saddam Hussein. This man has great credibility. He is opposed by two other factions within Iraq of Shiite important people. One is the son of a major Ayatollah also, the Ayatollah al-Sadr, the slum that the Shiites live in Baghdad, has been renamed after him from Saddam City to al-Sadr City. Now, al-Hakim and Sadr, and the third important figure, al-Sistani, who is another Ayatollah, differs from the other two, differs from al-Hakim and al-Sadr. Sistani is an old Ayatollah who believes in traditional Shiite Islam, which stipulates that Ayatollahs should not mix in politics. The Americans love him, and that may be the kiss of death. Over the short run, he may be very important because the American power is preponderant. But once the Americans leave, there's going to be a showdown, unless they reach a compromise, between al-Sadr, the old Ayatollah who was killed in 1999, his son, who has come to Iran to take a position of political importance. So I expect conflicts between the three tendencies, al-Hakim's, al-Sadr, and the third one, al-Sistani, with al-Sistani being the favorite of the Americans because he doesn't want an Islamic state. Al-Hakim has moderated his position, probably through negotiations. Initially, he wanted to establish an Islamic state. Now he's saying he could work with a coalition. He's very clever, and he could bide his time. He has God on his side.
Stuart Shaw is the co-author, along with Marvin Gettleman, of the Middle East and Islamic World Reader. He spoke with Robert Knight and Sharan Harper on WBAI's Wake Up Call. The Patriot Act was passed by the U.S. Congress right after the attacks of September 11, 2001, under the auspices of fighting terrorism. But it's come under fire recently as critics have charged that its implementation has led to the erosion of civil liberties. Professor David Cole at Georgetown University in Washington, co-author of Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security, asserts that the McCarthy era showed us that if we go along with the restriction of rights of others, our rights will eventually be at stake. Yesterday on Peace Watch, Cole advised that the Patriot Act II would give the Attorney General unchecked authority. He could pick up any foreign national on his say-so alone and strip U.S. citizens of their citizenship if they are determined to be associating with groups that we don't like. In addition, the Patriot Act II would allow secret arrest. The Attorney General would have the authority to disappear people, and the courts would have no redress. We continue our conversation with David Cole today regarding the research he did while writing his book.
There are so many stories. We tell a lot of the stories in the book. I mean, you know, of course, one that many people already know is the extensive efforts of J. Edgar Hoover to monitor Martin Luther King, including putting a tape into the hotel room that he stayed at in Washington, D.C., essentially to get evidence of extramarital affairs, and then threatened to use them against Martin Luther King on the eve of his obtaining the Nobel Peace Prize. We also tell the story of the FBI's investigation of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, which was an investigation in the 1980s that ultimately reached some 2,000 organizations, including several orders of nuns, in the name of investigating terrorism. Of course, this was at a time when the FBI was laboring under the FBI surveillance guidelines that Ashcroft has now relaxed, as being on the argument that they were too strict, and yet under these supposedly strict guidelines, the FBI spent 3 years investigating essentially a group of students, the Committees in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, that were engaged in no illegal activity whatsoever. Mm-hmm. We also tell the story of the LA-8, the Los Angeles 8, a group of Palestinian students who in 1987 were arrested, thrown into maximum security prison, and charged with being associated with a PLO group. And 16 years later, the government is still seeking their deportation for their political affiliations with a PLO group, even though within a month of their arrest, the director of the FBI testified in Congress that the FBI had investigated these individuals, found no evidence that they'd engaged in any criminal, mm-hmm. much less terrorist activity, and that if they were U.S. citizens, there would be no basis for their arrest. Yet, 16 years later, we're still seeking their deportation.
And so now these are pre-Patriot Act cases.
Oh, yes.
Are there any post-Patriot Act cases?
Oh, yes. We also talk about the implementation of sort of war on terrorism immediately after September 11th, the massive campaign of preventive detention, which John Ashcroft launched after September 11th, and the many, many people who were locked up in connection with that who had no connection whatsoever with terrorism. John Ashcroft's statements were that he was going to use every law he could find to lock up suspected terrorists and you know, prevent the next terrorist attack from occurring. But what we find is that in the first 7 weeks after September 11th, when they locked up 1,200 people, of those 1,200 people, only three have been charged with any kind of crime related to terrorism, and virtually all of the rest have not only not been charged with anything related to terrorism, but have been cleared by the FBI of any connection to terrorism. Yet many of them spent months in prison. Many received very abusive treatment, were interrogated at length, and were essentially locked up because of their ethnic and religious identity, not because of any good evidence that they were engaged in terrorism. Because if there was any good evidence that they were engaged in terrorism, you would see more than three out of 1,200 actually charged with some crime.
What can you tell us, David Cole, about the climate, the political climate that we live in today? Of course, McCarthy era, that was a senator that was driving that effort. This is John Ashcroft, the attorney general, who is spearheading this. Yet we've heard stories here on Peace Watch where, for example, one young woman flew an American flag upside down in her window, and she was subjected to so much verbal and even physical abuse and was ultimately fired from her job just for expressing, you know, her political opinion.
Right. Well, it's a time. I think there are many parallels actually to the McCarthy period in that it is a time of fear. Then we feared a worldwide revolutionary movement that was backed by the second largest superpower and that ostensibly had as one of its goals overthrow of the United States by force and violence. Now we fear a terrorist organization which launched the deadliest terrorist attack mankind has ever known and targeted us and has threatened to continue to target us. And so they're both times of great fear. And in times of great fear, people defer tremendously to the government. They look to the government for support, for safety, for protection. And government officials often, unfortunately, see constitutional rights and liberties as mere obstacles to, in their view, getting the job done. Because, of course, they can't predict the future. They don't know where the next terrorist attack is going to come from. And so what they do is what we've done in both eras is to engage in a kind of broad brush, guilt by association, stereotyped profiling and the like, in which we target many, many people who are entirely innocent of any illicit motives or illegal action and lock them up, freeze their assets, profile them, interrogate them. I think we're in many respects repeating the mistakes of prior periods. I think that much of the American public will go along because they feel that their rights are not at stake. But what the McCarthy era shows is that if you do go along in the early stages, your rights will eventually be at stake. And so it's important from the outset that we ensure that we strike a proper balance between liberty and security, because it is a balance.
Well, yeah, that was my question. At the same time, it's such a legitimate and valid concern to try and secure the homeland. How do you strike the balance of interest and our concerns, protecting the homelands and protecting our civil liberties at the same time?
Right. Well, we talk about that in the terrorism and the Constitution book. I mean, one thing to do is to focus on criminal activity. Terrorism is a crime. And when the FBI loses its focus on criminal activity, on terrorist crime, and instead begins to investigate political ideology and political activity, then you're wasting tremendous resources that are not keeping you safe. You're diverting those resources from investigations that might be much more productive, and you're chilling First Amendment protections in the meantime.
But now, in this case, some of a lot of the terrorist activity is connected with political ideology.
Oh, sure, and say, but that's always the case. But the problem is that if you sort of unmoor the FBI and you give them the authority to go out and investigate ideology without a focus on criminality, then you get you reach something that we reached in the 1960s, where the FBI was investigating scores of civil rights groups, women's rights groups, anti-war groups, peace groups, nuclear groups, and the like, who were engaged in no criminal activity whatsoever, but had a political ideology that was suspect. And so it's important, I think, to focus on crime. I think the other thing that's important is to try to develop affirmative ties to those communities where you have reason to believe there might be threats.
David Cole is a professor of law at Georgetown University and the co-author of Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. Are 51 Democratic state representatives from Texas a threat to the homeland? Well, apparently someone thought so. The Homeland Security Department that was created to protect us from terrorist attacks has been used domestically, according to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, to search for 51 Texas Democratic state representatives who left the state in order to break a quorum and block action on a redistricting bill. Under the Patriot Act, the FBI has detained approximately 1,800 immigrants since September 11th, mainly Arab and South Asian men. These detainees have little in common other than their ethnic origins. Yaju Damaraja, an organizer with the State Employees International Union Local 509 at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and a Sri Lankan immigrant, describes his experience of being targeted by the FBI, which was following up on a profiling tip it received.
July 5th, a Friday, 9 o'clock in the morning, we get a call. It's the outreach director for Massachusetts FEMA. They call it MEMA. And she goes, she mentioned her name. I said, I'm the outreach director of MEMA. And she said, you left a message about trainings. And I said, yes. Why do you want to do trainings? I said, well, my wife and I are about to go and want to go abroad to do refugee work in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And we need to really incorporate more skills into our repertoire and resume. And she said, okay. And she said, what do you do? I said, I'm a union organizer. What does your wife do? She's a documentary filmmaker at that time. And she goes, well, why do you want these trainings again? I said, we want to do relief and rehabilitation and refugee work. All right, you know, I'll send you some documents. 3-minute phone call. For some reason, the FBI has targeted Western Mass as being a cauldron of left-wing insurgents, Bolsheviks running around fighting the Trotskyists or something. But a FBI officer is now on the UMass Amherst police staff. So that following Wednesday, this FBI officer and a local police officer turned up at the door. My wife said, you know, come on in. And they were like, we're looking for Pilar and Yaju. And she goes, I'm Pilar. And they identified themselves. In fact, gave their cards. And he said, you know, I'm from the FBI. And we got a tip from MEMA saying that suspected terrorists wanted to document their trainings for terrorism use. This is the direct interpretation of this white, middle-aged bureaucrat conversation with me. I said we wanted refugee work. She said terrorist trainings. I said union organizer, documentary filmmaker. She said they wanted to take this back to Osama bin Laden. So what you're seeing is literally I said something through her own cultural filters and fears. She came up with something, you know, and based on that, she called the FBI. So they want to know where I was, why I was not there at the door. Then they want to know what organizations I worked for, who, you know, I was associated with, what did I do, why did we want to do FEMA trainings. You know, literally, they stopped short of saying, are you terrorist? Subsequently, our phones were bugged, and we're pretty sure of this. To this day, I can't imagine why they haven't upgraded their systems, but they still click each time you're bugged. I mean, come on. For a two-month stretch, it was like click, 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 click. What if I didn't have a pretty outspoken, and there's that word again, white wife? What if I didn't have a master's degree? Under the Patriot Act, I would have been screwed. The problem with the war on terrorism is it's not so much the vigor in combating terrorism, but the approach of it. I'm going to be targeted. And because of that, I'm the first to say, you know, let's end terrorism on both sides. State-sponsored terrorism and liberation terrorism. Killing people for the sake of your own political gains does not matter. However, the approach in the way this administration is coming after who they suspect to be terrorists. And once you are suspected of being a terrorist, constitutional protections are gone out of the window, leaving people like myself in constant fear and anxiety. The only reason I'm here today is because I'm not married to a Sri Lankan woman. I'm married to a white American citizen. So let me play out what could have happened if I was at home. The FBI visits. I answer the door. I stand my ground, refuse them entrance. My wife is not at home. They say, no, you don't have any rights, and you're coming with us. I say, no, there's a struggle. I'm taken in. Under Patriot Act 1, my wife comes home. Where the hell is he? She has no rights in asking for where I am, where I'm being held, what I'm being held on, what I did wrong. Can she see me? Pretty much all these 1,700 people detained are detained in absentia. You don't know where they are. The family must know where they are. And they can and will be deported and have been deported without any informing. In the Patriot Act 2, if you have any direct or indirect association with an official list, with the government's official list of terrorist organizations, you can and will be deported for that. Say I'm now in detention. I have been a Tamil activist back home in Sri Lanka. I have taken part in labor struggles there. And my master's thesis was fighting a U.S. multinational corporation in Sri Lanka. On top of that, my parents, on my dad's side of the family, are supporters of the Tamil Tigers. Not for the violence, but because of their belief that without a land, you don't have culture. And without culture, you're a nomadic people lost. So they support the Tigers' fight for land. That's an indirect and pretty direct association to an official terrorist group. To personalize this, if I was at home, I would not be here talking to you. I could be in Sri Lanka, potentially. But I'm not the worst case. You know, I'm really minimal compared to what has happened to other people. Again, I just played out a very likable scenario. What could have happened to me because I look and speak like this?
Yaju Dahamaraja is an organizer with the State Employees International Union Local 509 at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and a Sri Lankan immigrant. He spoke at a recent conference at the UMass Boston entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights. Special thanks to Mark Weaver at community radio station WMBR for production assistance with that report. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.